Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Brexit hangover in the UK and the uncertainty that has gripped the EU, with elections in Spain today that are expected to further rattle the fraying political centre as the contagion of populist insurrection spreads from the UK to Spain and possibly France too. Charles Grant, the director of the Centre for European Reform in London, joins us to discuss his article at the BBC, Brexit Throws Uncertain EU Off Balance, and the path of disintegration as opposed to integration that Europe appears to be on since the upset Brexit vote in the UK. We will also examine the conflicting messages from the head of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, who is calling for more power for European institutions, while Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, is warning against more centralization, noting that the elite failed to notice that ordinary people, the citizens of Europe, do not share Brussels' Euro enthusiasm. Then we'll speak with Cleo Pascal, who's a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, who is a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. She joins us to discuss her article at The Guardian, Post-Brexit UK Will Build Partnerships of Its Choice, and how the seismic shift in the British political landscape, with Prime Minister Cameron resigning and a revolt within the Labour shadow cabinet, as well as the possibility of a second Scottish referendum, does not mean that the UK is without options to form other blocs, while staying in the EU could mean that the UK would be subsumed into an increasingly dysfunctional Europe. Then finally, we'll look into the apparent upsurge of buyer's remorse and a growing movement called Regrexit that has 3 million signatures already on a petition to redo the referendum to stay in the EU. Toby Miller, a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, joins us to discuss the collateral damage of consuming the political establishment while people are taking a second look at the dubious political winners, Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, and the role of media baron Rupert Murdoch, whose influence was enormous in swaying the Leave vote, while his motives remain opaque. And joining us now from the UK is Charles Grant, who is a co-founder and director of the Centre for European Reform in London. Previously, he was a correspondent for The Economist in Brussels, covering the European community, then later became defence editor of The Economist, and is the author of Russia, China and Global Governance and How to Build a Modern European Union. He works on, among other subjects, EU foreign and defence policy, Russia, China, the Euro and global governance. His latest article at the BBC is Brexit Throws Uncertain EU Off Balance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Grant.
Hello.
And as much as there is apparently some buyer's remorse going on in the UK, is there any seller's remorse going on in the EU?
No, I don't think people in the EU institutions and other member state governments blame themselves for the British departure. I mean, with hindsight, maybe they should have been a little bit more generous to Cameron in his attempt to renegotiate the terms of membership, which concluded in February. They didn't give him enough to say he'd changed the way the EU works, but then they couldn't really give him much more than he got, because ideally he would have liked to have some limitation on the free movement rules, which were very controversial within Britain. But that would have gone against the absolute fundamental principles of how the EU works, which is that the single market involves the free movement of goods, services, capital, and labour. So I think I don't think people in other European countries blame themselves for the British departure. I think they blame Cameron for failing to control his own party and then running an inept referendum campaign.
And in terms of your organisation that you are the director of, Charles Grant, Centre for European Reform in London, the assumption is that there's a need for European reform. So tell our audience here in the United States what are the main reasons why there's a rejection of Brussels within the UK, obviously with the exception of London and Scotland and Northern Ireland? What is it that the British don't like about Brussels?
Well, it's some things which are real and some things which are fictional. The things that are real, which they don't like about Brussels, is that if you're a member of the EU, you have to allow in immigrants from other EU countries. And there are in Britain about 3 million citizens out of a population of 65 million from other EU countries. And that there's not an unemployment problem in Britain, so it hasn't created unemployment, but it's created, obviously, social change, cultural change, and, you know, arguably in certain industries put some downward pressure on wages. So that is a real reason why people are against the EU. The second reason is that they think that we've given up sovereignty. And of course, in some ways, that is true, in that the laws made in this country, many of them are made by the Westminster Parliament, but some of them are made by European institutions, and people don't like the sovereignty that has flowed to Brussels. But then there are other reasons people voted out, which are just based on misinformation and, frankly, lies spread by the media and the out campaigners. For example, one myth is that Turkey is joining the EU, which will give 76 million Muslims the right to march into our country and steal our jobs, which, of course, is a complete myth. Turkey won't join the EU in my lifetime, and I'm 57 years old. And I know that because I work on Turkey. But people believed it and feared it. Another myth was there's a European army being created and Britain will be forced to join a European army, which, again, is just rubbish. A whole load of these myths about Brussels were spread, which frankly, in my view, won the referendum campaign for the Leave side.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Grant, who's the co-founder and director of the Centre for European Reform in London. Is there, though, I mean, I understand that in some of the propaganda for the Leave vote, there were pictures of streams and streams of refugees from Syria and Afghanistan that happened a couple of summers ago in Europe. And they were sort of, they're coming at the gates of Rome. That kind of idea was obviously a part of that which some would call a kind of racist narrative. You're saying that it's a completely exaggerated and not even happening. But are we then to conclude in many ways that we're still sort of suffering, if you will, from the residue of the Iraq and Afghan wars in terms of destabilizing populations, et cetera? Or is that something that's just too far afield from the current problems?
Well, I think indirectly, the awful war in Syria, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people and led to millions of refugees, is the indirect consequence of the Allied invasion of Iraq 13 years ago. So that, and it is those refugees coming out of Syria across into Turkey, across the water from Turkey into Greece, which the EU has struggled to cope with and has been rather inept in handling, but has presented the EU in a bad light and made some people sort of associate the EU with refugees. And they've mixed up the issue of migration from Central Europe, which is one issue in Britain, with refugees streaming into the EU, which is a separate and different issue. And those refugees streaming into the EU don't have the right to come to Britain. But it all gets mixed up together by the popular press. So the three issues of EU migrants, refugees from outside the EU, and terrorists from outside the EU have all become conflated in the minds of some British voters.
Well, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who, of course, is inextricably involved with the Iraq war, along with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, he has an opinion piece in Sunday's New York Times, warning against that the center has to hold in effect, and warning against the upsurge of populism. How is his credibility in the UK? Because it seems like Corbyn tried to sit on the fence. Cameron was feckless, and in fact, he brought this self-inflicted wound upon himself in the first place. It's not as if there aren't enough problems in the world without creating them. So is there a problem in terms of the credibility of the political elite in the UK?
Well, yes, you are several questions there. Tony Blair himself is not really, he's very unpopular in the UK, partly because of the Iraq war for which he is held responsible, partly because since leaving office as Prime Minister about 8 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, he's become privately very wealthy and people resent that. So he has very little credibility now as somebody to convince the way British voters see any problem anywhere in the world. But on your more general point about political elites, yes, political elites in Britain are very unpopular, as they are in much of Western Europe and perhaps North America. And the European Union, all across Europe, has generally been a project of, if you call them centrist political forces, the centre-left or the centre-right. And those who don't like the European Union tend to be more extreme forces, the far-left and the far-right, particularly the right-wing populists are particularly strong in many European countries at the moment. So the EU has always been a creature of the centre. And if the centre becomes weaker, then that's very bad for the EU. And it is the weakness of the centre in British politics that has helped to undermine support for it, because the Tory party has become more right-wing and more extreme and more anti-European. And the Labour Party now has a leader, Jeremy Corbyn, whom you referred to, who is ambivalent at best on the issue of whether to stay in the EU. He did say he was for staying in, but during the campaign he spent a lot of his time criticising it. So I think the real problem the EU faces in many European countries is the weakness of the centre and the potential growth of support of extremes, though I don't actually foresee any other country following the British example and leaving the EU in the foreseeable future, because the British are, although there's Euroscepticism across much of the continent, the British are a bit of a special case. Their media is especially Eurosceptic. Their press barons are especially Eurosceptic. And the British Eurosceptics are even more hostile to the EU than are Eurosceptics in many other EU countries.
And Charles Grant, you mentioned earlier that you don't think that there is seller's remorse going on within the EU, but there is this division between the European Commission head, Jean-Claude Juncker, who's calling for more power for European institutions, while Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, is warning against more centralisation, noting that the elite fail to notice that ordinary people, the citizens of Europe, do not share Brussels' Euro enthusiasm. I'm quoting from your article. So is there a possibility of well, let's assume that in those two forces at play, will the Tusk come out on top, or will Juncker dig the hole deeper?
Well, as you rightly say, there are two different approaches, really, to how to respond to crises in Europe, whether it's the Brexit, the British exit, or the Eurozone's difficulties. The European Commission, the civil service at the heart of the EU, which writes new laws, which then has to be passed by ministers in the European Parliament, the European Commission, and Mr. Juncker, its president, certainly say, well, if there's a crisis, let's have more Europe. Let's have a more centralised federal Europe, brackets, more power for the Commission in the process, close brackets. That has been the traditional Commission response. But Mr. Tusk, who represents the government, he's chairman of the European Council, he's been saying very different things recently. He's been saying the more we talk about more Europe or centralising powers in Brussels, the less people love the EU. So let's just go easy. Let's not say that the solution to every problem is more Europe. Let's think very carefully and try to be pragmatic. Now, that is the view, the Tusk view, that is actually shared by most member state governments, including certainly the German government. So I think the Juncker response to crises, which is to centralise, is going to lose out, and the dominant response will be that of Mr. Tusk, which is to be very careful, very cautious, and don't think that just if the British vote to leave, the answer is more power to the Commission. It's not at all. You need to listen to people and work out what's gone wrong and try and reform the European Union to make it more attractive.
Well, just in closing, Charles Grant, since you were the defence editor of The Economist, what is the as the defence establishment saying in terms of the Britain's exit, given that you debunked this idea of a European army, but it's my understanding that the British have been kind of holding the EU's feet to the fire in terms of maintaining sanctions against Vladimir Putin over what happened in and what continues to happen in Ukraine. I noticed recently the German foreign minister referred to NATO deployments in the East as NATO warmongering. So there seems to be certainly a division within the European defence establishment as to how to deal with Putin.
Yes, that's right. Of course, Britain is staying in NATO, touch wood. So in terms of Europe's military defence, the British departure from the EU doesn't make a big difference. But in terms of the general response to Russian aggression in Ukraine, and in terms of the general security of Europe, British departure does make a difference, because when it comes to sanctions on Russia to punish it for its annexation of Crimea and its invasion of Ukraine, then the British have been in the forefront with the Poles and with the Germans of trying to keep the EU to maintain strong sanctions against Russia. And if the British are no longer around the table when the EU discusses sanctions, that's quite worrying for the Americans and others, such as the Poles, and at least Angela Merkel, if not all Germans, who believe in strong sanctions. I mean, certainly, although NATO is more important for hard security than the EU, the EU matters for soft security. It also matters for counter-terrorist cooperation and police cooperation. There are a lot of very little-known organizations and databases and agencies like Europol, the Police Cooperation Office, which come under the rubric of the EU. And Britain's going to leave these, so there is certainly a worry that there'll be less effective cooperation in fighting crime and terrorism if Britain leaves these organisations. Now, of course, there may be ways found to associate the British and allow them to be plugged into some of these organisations, but Britain won't be setting the rules anymore. And given the British expertise on counter-terrorist issues and other and fighting criminals, that'll certainly be a loss to the system. So I would argue that without the British and the EU, both the British themselves and their European partners may be less secure in certain ways.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Charles Grant.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Grant, who's the co-founder and director of the Centre for European Reform in London. Previously, he was a correspondent for The Economist in Brussels, covering the European community, then later became defence editor of The Economist, and is the author of Russia, China, and Global Governance, and How to Build a Modern European Union. He works on, among other subjects, EU foreign and defence policy, Russia, China, the Euro, and Global Governance. And his latest article at the BBC is Brexit Throws Uncertain EU Off Balance. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether a post-Brexit UK will be able to build partnerships of its choice.
Off your back. Well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and the author of Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Her latest article at The Guardian is Post Brexit UK Will Build Partnerships of Its Choice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure.
So, Cleo, is there a silver lining here? I mean, everything is pretty doom and gloom, and there's also, you know, regrexit going on, buyer's remorse inside the UK itself. What could possibly go right when everything seems to be gone so spectacularly wrong?
I think a lot has to do with the timeline. So if you're thinking about the next few months or even the next 2 or 3 years while the disengagement is negotiated, there'll be a lot of ups and downs. But ultimately, I think the outcome is positive. I think Europe, as currently structured, unfortunately, was a great idea, but doesn't work. And it didn't have a course correction of the magnitude that would be necessary to reshape it in progress. So ideally, this will help the EU realize that they have some problems and become more responsive to their members. But at the same time, for the UK, there are many, many potential benefits. So I heard you were just talking about, for example, the defense issues. If the UK had continued its integration in with the EU, it would have become more subject to EU policies around defense, which, for example, saw the German foreign minister last week criticizing NATO operations in Poland and in the Baltic states. So, you know, that's a very clear division between Western points of view on how to handle Russia, and I would much prefer to see an independent policy coming out of the UK that is more friendly to the NATO position as opposed to a kind of semi-appeasement that we were seeing out of the Germans. Similarly, on intelligence sharing, you have, the UK is an extremely valuable member of Five Eyes. If it was pulled tighter into the intelligence sharing network of the EU, there's questions about, first of all, whether that would be compromised if they have to share what's coming through that network with 27 other countries. And similarly, the question is, you know, whose purpose does it serve? Does it serve the EU's purpose? Does it serve the UK's purpose? Does it serve a US-UK Five Eyes type alliance purpose? So I think that, especially from the point of view of the US, this is a very good thing. And ultimately, I think that the EU is going to have very severe problems. And the UK cutting itself off and putting itself in a position where it's kind of a safe haven for currency, it has much more control over its foreign policy. It can perhaps start to implement an Anglosphere type of engagement where if it treats India with the respect that India now deserves, you can have an Anglosphere based in kind of Washington, UK, India that creates a different form of alignment. I think there are potentially a lot of positives if the disengagement is well managed.
And since you're Canadian, what is the? I noticed that Prime Minister Trudeau was just in France concluding a deal. Could Canada be a part of what you just talked about? The English speaking kind of.
Canada is a member of Five Eyes, as is Australia and New Zealand. So we already have a kind of an enhanced cooperation with other members and with those sorts of members. We're also, of course, a member of NATO. So, yes, I think it's completely viable. And basically, the question was whether the UK was going to become just one of another European country or whether it was going to become, you know, or retake its place as one of the main world capitals on things like defense, intelligence, trade. You can be sure traders love volatility and finding little leverages in the market. And as the rules get rewritten around the financial service sector, there will be all sorts of exploits included that will make London a favored location again. So there are a lot of potential upsides. It'll take leadership and it'll take vision. But if those things come through, you're looking at a resurgent UK that has the economic potential to become much more stable and a much stronger ally of U.S., old Anglosphere type values going forward.
And again, I'm speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. Her latest book is Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And her latest article at The Guardian is Post-Brexit, UK Will Build Partnerships of Its Choice. But just to touch on the political wreckage now in the United States with this seismic shift in the political landscape. Prime Minister Cameron's already resigned. There's a revolt within the Labour Party's shadow cabinet. There's going to be more blood on the floor tomorrow when they meet. There's a possibility of a second Scottish referendum. How long do you think it'll take before the dust settles? And given the populist bent of this and the inescapable comparisons to Donald Trump's racism and xenophobia that he's campaigning on, elements of which were clear in Farage and Boris Johnson's campaigning. Johnson himself referred to President Obama as the Kenyan with a anti-colonial hatred of the British. How is all of that going to emerge, and what will emerge in the political life of the UK in these intervening years as this transition that you've talked about continues?
So from a kind of leftist perspective, the framing of the discussion has always been, you know, it's those wonderful left of center governments in Europe that are keeping, maternal health care benefits, all that sort of stuff going in the UK. But once European countries start electing much more right-wing governments, if Marine Le Pen comes in France, for example, the view of that cadre of the left might change substantially. So does Scotland want to leave the UK to join up with rightist governments in Hungary and France and all those sorts of places? So the framing of the debate has been very much a byproduct of current domestic parliaments all across the EU. But those parliaments will change. And that's always been a problem with the EU, is you are subject to, your nation is subject to who gets elected in a lot of other nations. And who's going to get elected in a lot of other nations across Europe is going to change rather dramatically. So as Europe starts to shift politically itself, I think the debate within the UK about, for example, Scotland going to Europe is going to change rather substantially.
But today in Spain, there's a good chance that the far-left party Podemos will win. So it's not entirely...
They carry their own whole set of issues as well.
Right.
You know, kind of there is a, you know, so I think that as there is more tumult within the EU, which there was going to be with Brexit or without Brexit, the EU voters, because you're asking more about sort of the domestic political situation, is going to start to realize that maybe this is a good thing. And they don't want to have UK foreign policy subject to a far-left government in Spain or a far-right government somewhere else. And who knows what's going to happen in Germany itself. So, well, you know, there are a lot of cogs moving at the same time. And the UK was just the first big shift. But as the other pieces shift, the UK is in a very luxurious position because of the English channel, of being able to kind of decide who it's aligned to, right? It has the border with Ireland, but that can be managed. It was managed before. And as Europe becomes more complex, politically complex, the appeal of having a national government that you can control, if the British population decides they want left-of-center policies, they can vote in a left-of-center government. They don't have to wait for France to do it and Germany to do it, or, you know, Poland to do it or Hungary to do it. So I think as Europe becomes more unstable, which may have been accelerated by Brexit, but the seeds for that instability are in the compact of Europe to begin with, the position of the UK outside of that union will become clearly more desirable to large sections of the UK population.
But surely, Cleo Pascal, the companies in the UK that have integrated their businesses in Europe and depend upon European membership, won't they migrate to Ireland?
No. Well, first of all, there's kind of a bit of a fallacy that there's, you know, when they negotiate the departure, there's no trade agreements in place. These countries are all signatory to the WTO agreements. So there are baseline agreements there. It's not like suddenly there'll be no rules in place. And the UK, you know, they're different. They're different groupings that you're talking about. If you're talking about the business sector, so if suddenly the UK has rules that are highly preferential to the business sector, which is not unlikely when you have a conservative government and a very influential sector coming out of the city, they're very likely to write rules that are very attractive for investment. You know, that's why it's not a coincidence that a lot of the tax havens around the world are UK territories. They know how to leverage marginal differences in financial sectors. And the other thing is that, you know, you'll see with a more targeted migration policy, you know, where instead of taking in, you know, every kind of Spanish barista that wants to come through, they can focus on getting in Indian doctors or bankers or things like that, that the economy will become much more adaptable and much more focused and much more stable. Currently with migration, you know, I have a house in Reading, and my neighbor's a math teacher, and she has a high school math teacher. She has a class of 30 to 35 students. One year, they suddenly had 5 unilingual Polish speakers in the class. So they had to, the whole class had to retrench and figure out how to deal with the language issue. So they got in, they have very little funds, but they got them in to teach the Polish students enough English so that they could pass the math year and not hold back the whole class. The next year, those guys were gone, and it was Romanians and Bulgarians, and they had to start all over again with a different language issue. There was no ability, there was a very movable, the EU migrants, a very movable population, very difficult to plan social services, physical infrastructure, water availability, housing, you know, whereas if you get a kind of a more focused immigration policy, people are going to come and stay. They'll come and stay, they'll become part of the community, and you'll be able to plan around it. So instead of having this, 300,000 people moved into the UK last year. It's a medium-sized city. So there's no, it's not that, it's, the problem hasn't been that they don't want, the Brexiters don't want migration. They want migration. They want the, but they want the best of the world, not whoever happens to come across the channel from the EU.
Well, of course, that is Donald Trump's argument here in the United States. You know, among, not that he, there's any consistency or coherence, because he changes rather much on a dime. And the idea that the benefit of the Brexit would be to, empower offshore banking. offshore banking is not exactly the most popular thing. The idea of making the Cayman Islands even stronger is, there's a certain element of distaste in that, isn't there?
Oh, I completely agree with you. But the question was, is there going to be doom and gloom in the UK financial sector? Mm. And for reasons that may be distasteful, I think there is not going to be. I think it will benefit.
Right.
So that's the question. This isn't a moral response.
Exactly.
Reporting. And the issue of the difference between the US and Mexico and the EU and Europe and UK is very different, because actually the US's economic structure is built on that sort of migration, with the kind of low-cost farm labor and that sort of stuff. So it's not an economic parallel. The UK economic structure is not designed to benefit from this kind of flow of low-cost migrant labor.
So where do you, we talked a little bit about the political chaos. It'll take a while to settle. What kind of... the center is not holding in most countries, it seems. Here in the United States, you know, we had a socialist leading for a while on the Democratic side, who wasn't even a member of the Democratic Party, and Donald Trump is hardly your father's or grandfather's Republican. And there's a revolt within the Republican Party itself, where they're trying to figure out ways to dump this guy, and yet he's their standard bearer. So there seems to be an increasing kind of political turmoil going on. That's sort of the center's not holding, and the right and far right and the far left are in some kind of resurgence. How do you see things in about, say, you say we need about a 5 to 10 year window before the dust settles? Let's go to that in the last few minutes. just that sort of world that you're talking about 10 years since?
Well, there are a lot of major factors that we haven't discussed, like China, that will be real determining factors in what happens economically and strategically if you're looking at that time frame. So it gets extremely complex. But the first step towards kind of the center not holding, the reason that that didn't happen was because the media was very quick to dismiss the reasons that were causing Brexit, that was causing the support for Brexit, extremely dismissive. And so it's you hear a lot that it was kind of, you know, old people and poor people. I have a lot of friends in the defense community in the UK that, for some of the reasons we talked about at the beginning, were extremely supportive of Brexit. So these are we're in extremely complex times. And shows, you know, kind of discussions that get to these complex issues, like we saw leading up to the Brexit debates. The debates about Brexit were extremely beneficial for the Brexit side because people got to see, actually, that there was very little defense for some of those EU positions on the part of Remain. Remain became a very emotive issue as opposed to an actual factual issue. So shows, for example, like your shows, where you talk to a whole bunch of different people from a range of topics, is what can really help. More communication between kind of, you know, people who are policymakers, decision makers, to understand and not discount what people on the ground are actually saying and experiencing. So if that happens, then you can have a much more responsive political class that can adapt and change during these times of severe flux. Because we're heading into really rough times globally. Again, I mean, the China situation is quite serious, and you know, with the EU going to be going through some sort of collapse, you know, we're readjusting. So for the political class to kind of be more aware of what's going on, both Trump and Bernie were an indication that, you know, something's gone wrong with the way that this country is talking to itself. And generally in the UK, we saw it again around the Brexit debate. So we just need to listen. You know, listen and adapt as things move.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and the author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And her latest article at The Guardian is Post-Brexit UK Will Build Partnerships of Its Choice. And the rest of the program with Toby Miller from London talking about the buyer's remorse going on in the UK will be available in about 12:30 here today. Now we're going to go to a special fund drive program. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the apparent upsurge of buyer's remorse in the UK and the growing Regrexit movement.
Cottage small beside a field of grain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from London, in a cab in London, as a matter of fact, is Toby Miller, the Professor of Media and Cultural Studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday lives. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
And I wanted to talk to you about the buyer's remorse that seemed to be going on in the UK with the growing Regrexit movement that has 3 million signatures already on a petition to redo the referendum and stay in the EU. And I'd also like to talk about the collateral damage that's consuming the political establishment while people are taking a second look at the dubious political winners, Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, and the role of the media baron, Rupert Murdoch, whose influence was enormous in swaying the Leave vote, while his motives remain opaque. So let's begin with buyer's remorse.
Yes, there's no doubt there's a great deal of that, and there'll be more of it as the story unfolds, I think. I live in London. I'm one of the people who signed a petition saying that London should join the European Union on its own. We pay 50% of the taxes that go to the rest of the country from government expenditure, and we're one of the areas that voted, of course, to remain. But there's no doubt that people are having to rethink things based in part on the sudden plunge in value of the pound. I just arrived today from Colombia, where I had a much nicer week in that sense, in that there was the prospect of a peace accord finally bringing at least something approximating to an end to the terrible conflict in that country. But here, the pound has sunk. World markets are in total chaos. There are companies that are rethinking their desire to remain in Britain as employers. People are going to wonder about what happens to their retirement funding, partly because there are hundreds of thousands of retired British people who live in Spain and France in particular, who get very nice indexed welfare deals as a consequence of the European Union, which they may now lose. There are
They'll lose their health care and other things. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, there are two things that can happen. First of all, the National Health Service, which covers everybody who lives in Britain, which is a socialised health system, is part of a consortium all over the European Union, such that, for instance, if I go to Belgium or Italy and I need medical care, I'm treated very much in the same way as I would be here. Now, that's going to end. So that's a big factor. But also, people who are British citizens who have retired to Spain or France or wherever get a whole slab of welfare benefits, not just healthcare, from being members of the EU. And it's not clear that the payments that they get from being retired people in Spain will be indexed in the same way as Spanish citizens' retirement benefits would be. So they've got a lot to consider. Some of the areas that voted to leave, like Wales, areas that were important manufacturing sectors and also mineral extraction sectors, famously in the coal industry. The Welsh cities that have suffered from deindustrialization over the last 30 or 40 years have been recipients of vast amounts of European Union investment. We don't know what will happen to any of that in the future. It's hard to see it continuing. So, yes, there's going to be a heck of a lot of buyer's remorse.
And what is the am I correct? I know that there's absolute turmoil within the political establishment. Prime Minister Cameron has resigned. There's a revolt in the cabinet, Labour shadow cabinet, as we speak. A lot of Labour ministers were very unhappy about Jeremy Corbyn's lack of leadership in educating his working class voters who took the drank the Donald Trump Kool-Aid. So what is that amidst that wreckage? Aren't people also taking a second look at Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, the winners in quotes? I mean, these guys look, and first of all, Farage is just a total sleazebag. I mean, a despicable person. And Boris Johnson looks like a total clown, another Donald Trump.
Well, the two people within the Conservative Party, which is the governing party, who were the most prominent people for leaving were, as you say, Boris Johnson and also Michael Gove, who is a former education minister. Both of these people were very close to David Cameron, the Prime Minister. Johnson went to school with him. They all went to very fancy fee-paying schools, these guys. And now, of course, Cameron, who basically realized that the division within the Conservative Party could only be remedied if he took this incredible, foolish risk of having a referendum on being in the EU, because it's always been a sore point within the Tories. He was demeaned by them, as was his treasurer, George Osborne. Now they've won, and on the one hand, within the Tory party, you have many, many bitter opponents of Cameron who are delighted, but many people who are also running an anyone but Boris campaign for who should be the next prime minister. Gove is loathed on all sides of politics. Farage is, of course, head of another entity, the United Kingdom Independence Party. He's an interesting character in that he is actually a member of the European Parliament. Most of the UKIP success has been in the European Union's democratic institution. Ironically, of course, they've just voted themselves out of the job. They only have one person in the House of Commons who's a former Conservative Party person. So it's not clear what will happen to them. But what's weird is that you would normally expect that with a government tearing itself apart with the most incredible internal battles, that the opposition, in this case the Labour Party, would be cashing in. But it's only a matter of minutes ago that Hilary Benn, who is one of the children of Tony Benn, the famous Labour warrior figure of the 60s through to the 90s, was sacked from the shadow cabinet by Jeremy Corbyn. And tomorrow, when we speak, we're speaking on Sunday. Tomorrow, Monday, sees a big meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party where it is said that many, many, many members of Parliament will seek to unseat Jeremy Corbyn from a leadership because they, I think quite rightly, see him as having rather a weak, limp campaign. In 1975, a couple of years after Britain joined the European Union, as it's now called, there was also a plebiscite. And then Corbyn actually voted for leaving. And he continued to be an extremely significant critic of the EU throughout his campaign appearances, even though he said that it did some good things in terms of protection of labour rights and the environment. But basically, he was running the kind of campaign you can't get away with. Everybody in the United States knows, and this is one of the things that Trump does well and both the Clintons do well and Obama does well. You can't say, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, when you're running for office. You have to be definite. When you're actually in office, you can be very judicious. But not when you're running. You've got to show that you know what the story is. And Corbyn basically had a whole set of different stories running against him. So there are some suggestions that the white working class, particularly outside London, was literally only voting in favour for Remain in numbers of, say, one in four. The other big issue, of course, in this is that it means that if there is, given the crisis in both political parties, a general election called, which can happen really at any point if there's a vote of no confidence in the government of the day, then potentially the United Kingdom Independence Party, which Mr. Farage runs, could run riot through traditional Labour Party strongholds. If this white working class vote, which essentially appears to have been taken on an anti-immigrant spree, holds up in the general election and decimates the Democratic Socialist Party.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and he's joining us live from a cab in London. Now, let's talk a little bit about the pernicious role of the media baron, Rupert Murdoch. Unless you have something more to say about Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, I know I was not balanced, fair and balanced, as Fox says, in describing these two as anything but pretty sleazy characters. At least the fascist guy, Farage, is quite despicable. And Boris Johnson, it looks like a clown. I mean, how serious can people take him? I mean, just looking at him, he makes Trump's orange do-over look positively coiffed.
Well, it's interesting. Johnson is the former mayor of London. He is also a member of parliament, and he makes £250,000 a year. That's about, $300,000 before the plebiscite. Writing a column for the Daily Telegraph, weekly column, which is one of the very, very reactionary papers that supported an exit from the UK. On the one hand, he looks and talks like a clown, much as does Mr. Trump. On the other, he is a canny and cunning operator who knows how to tug at the heartstrings of people. In the case of Farage, a former city stockbroker, he is someone who knows how to appeal to the supposed rock-hard, solid, beating heart of everyday English masculinity. He's a white guy. He likes to drink beer. He likes to smoke cigarettes. He likes to say things that people are thinking but shouldn't say. That kind of naughty boy moniker is the model for these men in their different ways. And, of course, what it conceals frequently is very, very skillful political operatives. Now, in terms of your media question, Mr. Murdoch certainly is anti-EU, but he's not the only one. Most other media proprietors were also opposed to Britain remaining in the EU, so important tabloids, the Daily Mail, went that way, and so did the Daily Telegraph, which I mentioned before. But his newspapers, which run the gamut from the very conservative working-class orientation of the Sun through to the more middle-class, upper-middle-class London Times, all favoured a departure. The places that didn't were the much more sensible papers like the Financial Times, The Economist, The Guardian, and, funnily enough, The Sunday Mail. But there was a barrage of utterly misleading, absurd, anti-immigrant rhetoric that came from all of these papers in favour of leave. And the sadness was that the BBC, which is the place that many people get their news from, felt obliged under its enabling legislation to be, going back to language you used, fair and balanced, and give equal time to the parties. And what we didn't get enough of, which we got 40 years ago when the plebiscite was held before, was interviewers saying to politicians or newspaper journalists that they interviewed, that's not true, and here is why. Because, rather like the media in the United States, they run scared of these right-wingers claiming that they're all closet socialists. So if you pick up a right-winger on an absurdity about immigration, you're simply told off. And this is remarkable because just before the plebiscite, the Financial Times ran a poll that showed the difference between the British public's belief about A, the number of immigrants, B, the number of people from Eastern Europe, and C, the number of these people claiming benefits that live in Britain. And people's understandings of the figures were wild overstatements. Yet never was this properly challenged, even by the supposedly independent media in the shape of the BBC in the way that it should have been.
So, in other words, the BBC has had to resort to the US binary approach to the media coverage and news, which they still teach in journalism schools here in the US, that in the universe of discourse is an equal and opposite black and white opinions. There's only so every time you have a Democrat position, you immediately have the Republican position and so forth. And that, of course, has led to this situation now where Donald Trump is treated as an equal on the stage with Hillary Clinton. And even on NPR now, they refer to Donald Trump and they quote his lines such as crooked Hillary Clinton as a part of this fair and balanced convention. So there's no way to introduce any proportionality between these candidates. Is that what you're telling us?
I'm afraid that's exactly what I'm telling you.
So let me just touch on some of the stuff that Boris Johnson said. I mean, first of all, I don't see how the Tory party, we talked about how the Labour Party is collapsing from within. And on Monday, you're suggesting at their meeting there may be more blood on the floor. But I understand that Boris Johnson, they were hurling insults at each other, the Tories, but Johnson at one point referred to President Obama as the Kenyan who is gripped by anti-colonial hatred of the British. How is this clown going to be able to come to the White House and be treated civilly?
Well, it's quite true that he said that in one of his columns. He claims that this is not about race. It is simply to do with the fact that Mr. Obama, President Obama's father was Kenyan. But of course, it's race baiting, and it's particularly injurious coming from Johnson, who was born in New York, who has Turkish and Russian family background, whose father was a very successful European Union functionary. I mean, the whole thing is just absurd. But quite apart from that, it's deeply offensive. Deeply offensive. And to me, that kind of conduct gives the lie to the notion that this is an argument about sovereignty, which is what the Leave people claim. This is an argument about English whiteness and old imperial notions of domination. That is the shocking truth behind it. And I can understand why the white working class is as skeptical as it is, because the Labour Party has betrayed its interests over the last 20 years. The horrors of the Blair regime not only visited upon it on battlefields, but also visited upon it in terms of the failure of the Labour Party to stand up for unions and stand up for working people's rights and engage in proper ameliorative programs to deal with the side effects of globalization. The sad thing is that what Murdoch and Johnson and Gove and Farage and the other cabal of monsters has done is to convince these people that this is all to be blamed on Polish plumbers, on Romanian welfare cheats, and a whole bunch of other crude, ludicrous stereotypes, deeply offensive, deeply xenophobic, and deeply racist. And that's what won the day. And it's just a tragedy, you know, that this shell game of deception was played by these people. On Farage's part, no doubt because he believes in it. On Gove and Johnson's part, no doubt because they are both hoping to become prime minister in the wash-up.
Well, just in closing, though, back to the media baron, Rupert Murdoch, whose influence was enormous in swaying the Leave vote, but his motives have been extremely opaque. What were his motives, do you think?
Well, as you say, they're opaque, and it isn't entirely clear to me, but in terms of his political economic interests, the European Union is much more interested in decent regulation of media ownership and media barons' conduct than is the British government. So that would be one factor, without a doubt. Another factor would be that our attempts at a very technical level within the European Union to break down some of the power that Murdoch has in cable television in particular. For instance, one of the ways he makes a lot of his money is through sports and being able to charge different amounts of money in Italy, in Britain, in other countries, for access to football, to soccer rights. And the EU wants to break that down and make it possible to say, well, you charge more than a certain amount in one country if you charge it in another. So he has some raw political economic interests at stake, as well as issues of democratic regulation of the way in which he conducts himself.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and cultural studies at Cardiff University, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and he joined us from London. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.